It was because of Plaw Yeshti and the heavy losses on many other raids that the AAF sped up the training time for McGovern and his crew and all the others preparing to enter the battle. By the late summer of 1943, American industry was producing enough planes, but there was a bottleneck. Not enough combat crews. The 8th Air Force had nowhere near enough pilots to fly the B-17s and B-24s available in England. General Arnold noted with great concern that not even by December 1943 would the AAF be able to provide replacements and reinforcements enough to allow the 8th to operate at full strength. Neither could the other air forces in the Pacific or North Africa. Planes without pilots and crews were as useless to the AAF as runway behind a landing airplane. Progress was being made on the ground. After the Allies had taken Sicily and in September had invaded mainland Italy, the American Fifth Army was moving north along the west coast after some frightfully rough going at Salerno, while the British First Airborne Division had taken Taranto and Brindisi on the east coast and quickly captured Bari on the Adriatic. The British Eighth Army, meanwhile, was driving north. By October 5, the Americans had captured the port at Naples, while the British had taken Foggia, which was surrounded by now-defunct German and Italian airfields. Italy, after overthrowing Mussolini, had surrendered, but the country was immediately occupied by German troops who used Italy's rivers and mountains to form a formidable defense across the country. Still, southern Italy was in Allied hands. That opened opportunities for the AAF. From the airfields around Foggia, American bombers could participate in the Combined Bomber Offensive, CBO. Italian-based bombers could hit targets in the Balkans, Czechoslovakia, Austria, and southern and eastern Germany. Ploiești's oil, the Danube River supply route, Wiener Neustadt's industries, and others would be in range of B-17s and B-24s. Along with fighter aircraft, the heavy bombers could support Allied ground armies as they continued their drive north, up the peninsula. There were more advantages, or so it was argued among the Allied high command. Basing a large heavy bomber force in Italy would ease the congestion in England brought on by the airfield requirements of the 8th Air Force. Better weather conditions in Italy than in England would make it possible to strike more blows against the enemy. From Italy, two of the largest German aircraft factories, which together produced 60% of the enemy's fighters, would be in range. The Germans would be forced to move half of their fighters to the southern German front, thus relieving the hard-pressed 8th Air Force. American bombers flying from Italy would enjoy the shield of the Alps against the German radar warning system. Further, a major new base around Foggia could be quickly brought into being by stripping the 6 groups of heavy bombers assigned to the 12th Air Force in Libya. Those groups would serve as a nucleus for the new force, and 15 additional groups could be diverted from current allocations to the 8th. Despite these points, General Ira Eaker had strenuous objections to the plan. He was naturally alarmed at the prospect of losing bombers previously earmarked for his 8th Air Force. He said sending them to Italy would violate the basic principle of concentration of force. He doubted that the necessary fields could be provided in Italy, and wondered where on earth the AAF would get the ground crews necessary to keep the bombers flying. And he questioned the weather argument. He said that the critical factor in daylight attacks was weather over the target in Germany, not weather in England. He pointed out, too, that the Alps would constitute a serious obstacle to the safe return to base of damaged aircraft. General Arnold ignored Eaker. In mid-October, he sent Eisenhower a directive for the establishment of a new air force in Italy with a primary mission of strategic bombing. General Karl Spatz would take command of the United States Army Strategic Air Forces in Europe, while General James Jimmy Doolittle, who had led the famous B-25 attack on Tokyo in 1942, would replace Eaker as commander of the 8th. The new force, to be called the 15th Air Force, would be commanded by General Nathan Twining. Eisenhower agreed. At the end of November, with an advanced echelon already established at Bari, on the Adriatic south of Foggia, staff officers and other supporting personnel began moving to Bari. On December 1, the 15th Air Force opened its headquarters there, where it would stay until the end of the war. That fall, to prepare for the coming of the heavy bombers, engineers began the construction of heavy bomber fields around Foggia. In spite of great difficulties imposed by rain and mud, insufficient equipment and personnel, and poor transportation, plus bomb damage to the airfields previously used by the Germans, by the end of December, the engineers were completing construction on more than 45 airfields, including ones for medium bombers in Sardinia and Corsica. The work ranged from repairs and drainage to putting down paved or, more often, steel plank runways. And they laid pipelines for aviation gasoline from Bari to Foggia. Thus was the 15th Air Force born. Initially, it consisted of 6 heavy bomber groups and 2 fighter groups, but it would soon become the 2nd largest air force in the world, behind only the 8th in total numbers of planes and personnel. By April 1944, it had 21 heavy bomber and 7 fighter groups. Even on moving day, December 1, 1943, the 15th struck a blow, bombing ball-bearing factories, bridges, and railway facilities in northern Italy. But the next night, the Luftwaffe sent a flight of bombers to Bari. About 30 Allied ships were being unloaded, and when darkness fell, lights were turned on to keep the unloading on schedule. At 7:30 p.m., the German bombers struck. In 20 minutes, without loss to themselves, they left 19 transports destroyed and 7 severely damaged. 2 ammunition ships received direct hits, as did a tanker carrying oil, causing an immense fire. Over 1,000 workers were killed, and it took several weeks to bring the port back to full operation. Welcome to the war. The 15th went to work anyway. Just before Christmas 1943, it carried out a mission against the Messerschmitt plant at Augsburg. In the new year, it supported American landings at Anzio, south of Rome. In these and other missions, it used the new Sperry bomb sight, plus radar, which allowed the lead bomber to pinpoint the target through cloud or smoke cover, or so at least it was hoped. In February, the 15th joined with the 8th in the first coordinated attack of the U.S. Army Strategic Air Forces in Europe. It was the big week when the 8th and 15th targeted German aircraft factories and a ball-bearing plant at Steyr, Austria. On the last day of the big week, more than 1,000 bombers, a record, from the 2 air forces struck Regensburg, Augsburg, Fürth, and Stuttgart. The damage done was frightful to behold. So were the losses. On the record-breaking day, 64 bombers were lost, 33 of them from the 15th. The week's total cost to the 15th was 90 aircraft and their crews. Through March, April, and May, the 15th stayed at it. In that period, it received 25 sets of the new APS-15 radar, known as Mickey, complete with operators. On April 5, 1944, 230 bombers from the 15th raided Ploiești, the first time it had been hit in 8 months. More Ploiești missions were carried out on April 15 and 24, on the last raid using the Mickey for the first time. On D-Day in Normandy, June 6, 1944, the 15th raided Ploiești again, and then again on June 23 and 24, and again on July 9 and 15. Losses mounted. 10 B-24s on one mission, 14 on another, 20 on another, 46 on the July missions, this out of a force of between 200 and 300 bombers. Missions against other targets in the first half of 1944 were equally costly. Meanwhile, the 8th Air Force, which had spent much of the time before D-Day bombing tactical targets such as bridges and railroads in France in preparation for the assault, did its own strategic bombing and suffered similarly heavy losses. The campaign in France was called the Transportation Plan, and was much objected to by General Spatz, who wanted, instead of hitting bridges and trains in France, to be conducting strategic missions inside Germany. But Eisenhower, the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force, had insisted on the transportation plan. To him, the closer to the front lines the bombers did their work, the better. After many loud arguments, and only after threatening to resign his post if not given temporary command of the AAF in Europe, Eisenhower got what he wanted, but only for the invasion. On June 8, Spatz issued an order that remained in force until the war ended. The primary aim of the 8th and 15th Air Forces would be to deny oil to the enemy. Following that order, Ploiești and other oil refineries were the major targets. How could the Germans take such punishment? How could they defend their country? Where did they get the fighters, the pilots, the anti-aircraft guns, their tanks and trucks, their ammunition? These questions were difficult for the AAF to answer, especially since the feeling had been that just one more blow, or two, or three, would do it, and the Germans would pack it up. Nothing like that happened. The Germans made vast efforts to disperse their aircraft factories, and at the end of 1943 were producing twice the number of fighters estimated by the Allies. At that stage of the war, German fighter pilots were among the best in the world. German technical knowledge and skill were equally outstanding. They were bringing a rocket-propelled fighter, the ME-163, and a jet-propelled fighter, the ME-262, online. Despite many attacks on aircraft-producing factories, the Germans built 2,177 single-engine, propeller-driven fighters in June 1944, compared to 1,016 in February 1943, and more than 3,000 in September. The jet aircraft were the most serious threat, and the 15th went after the jet factories in Friedrichshafen in a series of July raids. A post-war assessment determined that these missions destroyed 950 jet aircraft, fewer than the estimates at the time, but still an impressive result. The raids on ball bearing plants had caused much physical damage, but had hardly interrupted the flow of ball bearings to the factories where they were needed. Indeed, German armaments production increased sharply in early 1944 and threatened to rise even more during the second half of the year. Having France, the Low Countries, Norway, and Central and Eastern Europe as a source of almost unlimited slave labor helped. Oil was the critical item. Ploiești remained the principal target. It was attacked by the 15th Air Force, but following the April attacks, the Germans began to experiment with a new defensive measure, which, for at least a time, worked well. Whenever their warning system indicated the approach of the 15th's air fleets over Yugoslavia heading toward Romania, the Germans would use the time available to them before the bombers were over Ploiești, about 40 minutes, to light hundreds of smoke pots around the refineries, so that when the bombers were over the target, most of the area would be concealed. As a counter, the 15th began using more radar-equipped leading planes and raised its level of accuracy. But the German counter was to move additional anti-aircraft batteries into and around Ploiești, along with fighter aircraft, making it the third best defended target on the continent. Second was Vienna, also a crude oil refinery site often struck by the 15th. First was Berlin. The 15th countered with new techniques, most of all the use of diamond-shaped formations that gave some additional security to the bombers and greater precision in its attacks. In July 1944, the 15th lost 318 heavy bombers in its many missions against refineries scattered across southern Europe. It was the worst month of the war for the 15th, which had a higher ratio of loss than the 8th. The AAF thought, however, that it was doing great damage to the refineries, especially because of its use of radar to overcome the smoke screens. The results may not have been quite as good as hoped, but still, they were spectacular. It was the sustained offensive by the 15th that finally rendered Ploiești all but useless to the Germans. By September 1944, a total force of 59,834 airmen from the 15th had flown against Ploiești, dropped a total of 13,469 tons of bombs at a cost of 350 heavy bombers. The 15th had flown 20 daylight missions against Ploiești. Later estimates were that these raids denied the Germans 1.8 million tons of crude oil. When the Red Army took Ploiești on August 30, the Russians reported that the Ploiești refineries were idle and ruined. This was the payoff of the 15th's sustained campaign. On August 30, with the Red Army overrunning the country, Romania abruptly changed sides in the war. That development, in turn, led to a buoyant episode for the 15th Air Force. There were over 1,000 AAF men who had bailed out over Romania and were being held there as POWs. Those in camps near Bucharest were in danger of being evacuated to Germany or having to spend a long time in Russian hands before they got home. One of the internees, Lieutenant Colonel James A. Gunn III, took matters into his own hands. He climbed into the radio compartment of an ME-109 after painting it with the stars and stripes. He had persuaded Captain Cantacuzin, a prince of the royal family of Romania, who was the top Romanian ace against the Allied aircraft, to be his pilot. Cantacuzin flew Gunn to Italy and managed to land safely. Gunn talked General Twining into sending a rescue mission. Twining had the 15th hurriedly convert 56 of its B-17 bombers into transports and had Cantacuzin fly a P-51, there was no suitable fuel for the ME-109, to the airport outside Bucharest to see if it was clear of Germans. It was, and the B-17s started coming in. The POWs, happy beyond belief, crowded into the bombers, 20 of them in each plane, and flew back to Italy in relays. In all, 1,274 of them got out over a three-day period. Deloused, fed, and treated as necessary in hospitals, they were soon on their way to the States. The losses the 15th inflicted on the German refineries vastly aggravated the fuel crisis faced by the Germans, bringing the enemy's fuel position to the point of catastrophe. In his memoirs, Inside the Third Reich, the Nazi production czar, Albert Speer, said, "I could see the omens of the war's end almost every day in the blue southern sky when the bombers of the American 15th Air Force crossed the Alps from their Italian bases to attack German industrial targets." 8th Air Force attacks on the armaments industry, especially tank, truck, and aircraft factories inside Germany, also led to shortages for the enemy. Strategic bombing was paying off, which helped Spots ward off proposals to attempt to terrorize the Germans into capitulation through night bombing of cities. American losses mounted. In the summer of 1944, out of its 2,100 operational heavy bombers, the 8th Air Force lost more than 900. The 1,100 operational heavy bombers of the 15th Air Force suffered a still higher ratio of losses. But the German losses were even higher. The Luftwaffe had combat losses in personnel that climbed from 31,000 to 44,000 per month between June and October. The presence of the American P-51 long-range fighters, beginning in mid-1944, provided the American bombers with air cover all the way to the target. They made a critical contribution to the German losses. Indeed, some historians contend that it was the coming of the P-51 that made the continuation of the strategic bombing campaign possible. It surely helped. But the biggest problem for the Germans was fuel. The Ploiești raids and others had the enemy down to 20% of the fuel needed to continue the war. Training in tank warfare, for example, became for the Germans a luxury beyond reach. The German army had to abandon most of its trucks and other vehicles and revert to being a horse-drawn army. For the airmen, what mattered most was the cutbacks the Luftwaffe was forced to adopt, especially in its training period for pilots, which was reduced to a few insufficient days. Further, along with a severe shortage of good pilots, morale in the Luftwaffe was declining or becoming almost non-existent. German pilots were not rotated out of combat and made into instructors after a certain number of missions. They continued to fly until killed, which a steadily growing number of them were. Increasingly, the Germans had to rely solely on their anti-aircraft guns to defend their cities. They had come to realize that it was not possible to stop an Allied bomber from dropping its eggs on a target. Their goal was to cause the casualty rate to be high enough to force the Allies to discontinue the raids, something they could never accomplish. But if the Germans were having morale problems, so were the Americans. The airmen suffered greatly from the intensive scale of operations, from high operational losses, sometimes from the lack of sufficient fighters for escort, from the almost unbearable pace of missions on consecutive days. General Arnold had long planned to provide 2 crews for each bomber, so that every man would feel that he had a chance of surviving his tour of 35 missions. But trained crews were not being produced fast enough, and it was not until December 1944 that the 15th Air Force attained the ratio of 2 crews for each bomber. Morale was so low that rumors were widespread in the AAF about pilots and crews landing in neutral Sweden or Switzerland, not because their bomber was so badly damaged that it could not return to base, but just to get out of the war. The stories said the men, who had thus opted for safety over risk, were enjoying a comfortable sojourn while they were interned. Investigation revealed that such reports were almost wholly inaccurate. The bombers that landed in the neutral countries had indeed been so shot up that the pilots had no choice. That many airmen nevertheless believed the rumors was an indication of how low morale had sunk. This was the situation into which George McGovern and his crew, along with all the other replacements and reinforcements, were headed. McGovern would be joining the 741st Squadron, 455th Bomb Group, in September 1944. The group also included the 740th, 742nd, and 743rd Squadrons. It was based at San Giovanni Field near Cerignola, Italy, a bit south of Foggia. The 455th shared the base with the 454th Bomb Group, both being part of the 304th Bomb Wing. The 455th's emblem was the Vulgar Vulture. Walt Disney Studios in Hollywood did the artwork. It was a vulture with a bomb in its talons. The emblem, often called a patch, was worn on the left breast of flight jackets by the crews. The group's tail marking had a black-colored diamond shape on the upper half of both vertical stabilizers and yellow-painted lower stabilizers and rudders. The squadron symbols were on the upper rudders, a black rectangle for the 740th, a black four-leaf clover for the 741st, a black diagonal stripe for the 742nd, and a black horizontal stripe for the 743rd. The aircraft had their numbers painted on both sides of the rear part of the fuselage. These markings were necessary during rendezvous to ensure that the plane joined the proper group formation. The 455th's first commander was Colonel Kenneth A. Cool. He was an experienced airman with over 16 years of flying experience. He had flown B-24s for the 8th Air Force over Germany, then flown in North Africa and from the Libyan desert. His sense of humor, along with his competence, endeared him to his men. So did his continual puffing on his pipe. His expression when a piece of information surprised him was, "Well, I'll be dipped in gravy." His group headquarters B-24 was named Best We Do, after another of his common sayings. He often led the group into combat. When it was announced during pre-mission briefings that Colonel Cool would lead the formation, whispers of approval could be heard from the combat crews. The 455th flew 139 missions before November 1944. May was its busiest month, with 21 missions. The group put 745 B-24s over targets, dropping over 1,630 tons of bombs. Losses were severe, but the group kept at it. At least enemy fighters were, by late August, no longer much of a threat, but accidents and even more German anti-aircraft batteries, usually 88s, sometimes including 105s, were more dangerous than ever. Once, at least, in April, the flak that hit one plane brought down 2 of the B-24s. Lieutenant Jerome Slater was the pilot of one of them. Lieutenant Michael Callan had the controls of the other. After completing a bomb run over Porto San Stefano, Italy, flying in a diamond formation, Callan had Slater's B-24 and another bomber tucked up under each of his wings. Slater's plane was hit by a flak burst on its number one engine. It severed the wing, and his plane immediately went out of control. It rolled to the left as it flipped over on its back and struck Callan's plane, back to back. Debris was flying everywhere, reported the six-plane flight leader, Lieutenant Eugene Hudson. Only one parachute was seen to open. The 20 crewmen were listed as missing in action. Callan's regular navigator, Lieutenant Guy Kuntz, was flying with Hudson that day. He wept all the way home after witnessing his crew lost. In August 1944, after the 455th's 100th mission, Colonel Kuhl was transferred to 304th Wing Headquarters as operations officer. Lieutenant Colonel William L. Snowden of Oakland, California, a graduate of the University of Texas, replaced him. Like Kuhl, Snowden was immensely popular. McGovern would become part of a war that, after Rome was liberated on June 5 and after D-Day in Normandy on June 6, every participant in Italy, whether on the ground, at sea, or in the air, would call the Forgotten War. For the men of the 15th, what they resented most was the maximum publicity given to the 8th Air Force. This was not only because it was bigger and had more of the glamour bombers, the B-17s, but also because reporters preferred England to the Italian campaign. Movie star Jimmy Stewart flew as a squadron leader in a B-24 for the 8th and was generally regarded as an absolute top pilot. Clark Gable also flew with the 8th, as did many youngsters soon to be famous, including reporters Andy Rooney and Walter Cronkite. This led to even more publicity for the 8th. In the little less than a year and a half that the 15th was in operation, it had 3,544 B-24s and 1,407 B-17s. Of these, 1,756 B-24s and 624 B-17s were shot down in combat. Chapter 5. Cerignola, Italy. In 1492, Christopher Columbus became the first Italian-born man to set foot in the New World. Over the 450 years that followed, hundreds of thousands of Italians came to America in his wake. From 1943 to 1945, 1 million and more Americans, many from Italian-American families, others whose parents or grandparents or ancestors had been born elsewhere in Europe or in Asia or Africa, came to Italy. They were mainly young men, overwhelmingly in the armed services of the United States. They came not to settle and start a new life, not to conquer, but to undertake an air offensive against Germany and its satellites, to drive the German occupiers from Italy, to liberate the country and allow it to choose its own government. They came to the mainland right after the Italians had overthrown Benito Mussolini, but evidence of his two-decade rule was all about them. Italy was in ruins. Mussolini was no Hitler or Stalin, but he was, nevertheless, a disaster for North Africa and a catastrophe for Italy. He had turned a country of skilled artisans and expert farmers, full of so much life and spirit and art and fine food and wine as to be an object of envy to much of the rest of the world, into a country virtually without young men, a country that made almost nothing, a country on the verge of widespread starvation. He had gathered up nearly all the young men and forced them into his army, which he hoped, against all reason, would make Italy into a major power. By 1943, it was a country of old men, women, and children, almost all of them hungry, ill-clad, suffering medically and in nearly every other way. The American servicemen had grown up believing that Italy was poor, a place to escape from, but they had no idea, until they arrived, that Mussolini had made the country destitute. What Mussolini had not done, the Germans did. In their retreat north, after the Allied invasion of the mainland in September 1943, the Germans had taken with them damn near everything, virtually all food, wine, vehicles of every type, whether horse-drawn or machine-powered or pushcart, artworks, whatever they could carry. One afternoon in September 1944, George McGovern and his shipmates arrived in Naples Harbor. From the deck, they could see dozens of little boys lined up on the wharf, holding out their hands and yelling in broken English, Babe Ruth, or Hershey bars, or gum. Just as the Americans began to reach into their pockets, the ship's loudspeaker came alive, and the captain said, Now look, nobody throw anything to these children. These kids are starving, and a couple of days ago an American ship came in here and the soldiers started throwing candy bars and the kids jumped into the water to get some, and several of them drowned. We don't want to repeat that. We came to help these people, not to drown their kids. Don't throw anything. I mean anything. McGovern recalled them as spindly-legged kids with pale faces, and he admitted, This was my first exposure to people on the edge of starvation. Outside Naples that night, in an AAF base, he could hear mothers scrounging around in the garbage cans looking for scraps of food that they could take home to their kids. The American soldiers had come out of the Depression. Many of them had been deprived, but none of them had ever known anything like this. To the Italians, they were incredibly rich. Their uniforms were far better than those of the Italian army, and much superior to those of the German army. They had what seemed to be unbelievable quantities of food, gasoline, weapons, trucks, jeeps, airplanes, tents, medical supplies, cameras, money, movies and projectors, and more. The newly arrived Americans were discovering the vast difference between their country and others, even their closest ally, Great Britain. Lieutenant Roland Pepin, assigned as navigator to the same 741st Squadron, 455th Bomb Group as McGovern had been, also came to Italy by ship, but Pepin's rusty old tub had deposited his crew in Tunis, where they transferred to a British luxury liner for the journey across the Mediterranean to Naples. That sounded nice, and it was, for the officers, not for the enlisted men. Pepin found that the British have an entirely different approach than us to the separation of officers and enlisted men. As an officer, he was in a stateroom with one other man, with all the luxury usually granted first-class passengers. The enlisted men were in the bowels of the ship, packed like sardines, sleeping in hammocks. Sanitary facilities for the enlisted were a disgrace, causing a stench that was inhumane. McGovern, Pepin, and the hundreds of other AAF reinforcements and replacements boarded trucks for the drive across Italy, almost straight east to the airfield some 5 miles outside Cerignola, about 20 miles southwest of Foggia. Cerignola was reputed to have been a center for Mussolini's fascist party and had become a place of refuge for Italians fleeing the frequent Allied bombing of Foggia. Before the war, it had been a town of 25,000. But by 1944, it contained about twice that, none of them young men. The name Cerignola meant land of cereals, and it was thus the origin of the word Cheerios. It grew hard wheat, the best in Italy, and possibly the best in the world, for making pasta. The Romans stored the wheat in the ground, silos in reverse. They covered the holes with wood that kept the water out when it rained. There are still 600 such storage places in and around Cerignola today, all with Roman numbers on them. According to local people, this is the only place in the world where hard grain was preserved in this way. Mussolini, however, had sapped Cerignola's resources for his army, and in 1944, one could not tell that it had once been a major agriculture center for the Romans. Although it was generally flat and fertile, with plenty of rain, by 1944, almost nothing was cultivated there. The olive trees were neglected. The people were even worse off. An AAF medical officer wrote a description. The town was a reservoir of malaria, venereal disease, and dysentery, with flies and mosquitoes to ensure spread. The streets were filled with pot-bellied bambinos, openly defecating in emulation of their elders, because there was no sewer system or toilets. They ate food, when they could get it, on the black market, obtained from fly-infested fruit stands and vermin-filled butcher shops where rotten meat was the rule. There were no medicines. The death rate among children was appalling. The splenic index was 40%, and malaria was a children's disease. All the adults had it long since. Avitaminosis, tuberculosis, and frank starvation were everywhere. The only music to be heard was the sound of a passing funeral, and that band had a full-time job. Cerignola was an ancient city. On June 29, 1863, its modern cathedral had its first stone placed as the American Civil War was being fought, even as Robert E. Lee's army was marching into Pennsylvania for what would be the Battle of Gettysburg. The cathedral's dome stood out. Pilots could see it from 10 miles away. "Many times I was reassured that I was on course when that dome loomed up ahead of us," McGovern recalled. It is still there in the 21st century, upgraded and active. Nearby were the ancient ruins of Cannae, site of one of the most famous battles ever fought. In 216 BC, Hannibal of Carthage set up his base at Cerignola because of the grain stored there. 11 miles away at Cannae, Hannibal's force encircled Roman troops that outnumbered his army by 2-1 and, in a single afternoon, destroyed them. Most of the Americans had never seen a building as much as 100 years old, nor a battlefield that went back as far as the mid-18th century, much less 2 millennia. One AAF pilot of the 456th Bomb Group, Lieutenant Robert S. Capps, was so intrigued by Cannae that he visited the site and later wrote a biography of Hannibal. When the Germans retreated and the British Eighth Army swept past, the people of Cerignola hoped they were out of the war. They were not. In January 1944, when the AAF arrived to transform the area around Cerignola into a major airfield, an incredible storm of activity began. Massive numbers of ground support vehicles and huge amounts of materiel arrived. There were more than 2,000 young men at the base from the 455th and the 456th bomb groups. Army olive-drab tent cities sprang up among the olive groves, along with massive amounts of ground support equipment, fuel, bombs, ammunition, food, medicines, and other supplies, which continued to arrive daily. The people of Cerignola began to learn about the way Americans made war. They had never seen anything to match it. Lieutenant Colonel Horace W. Lanford, 25 years old, was the first commander of the 741st Bomb Squadron. He arrived in Cerignola early in 1944. At that time, the town was only 60 miles south of the front lines. The airfield, bombed by the 15th Air Force in 1943 and then abandoned by the Germans, was in poor condition. The group had 64 B-24s. Lanford had flown in with them. There were no hard stands, parking ramps, so the group had to line up the bombers either wingtip to wingtip or nose to tail on what little runway there was. Still, the pilots managed to take off and land. On their early missions, to help morale on the stalemated beachhead at Anzio on the western coast of Italy, the Cerignola-based bombers formed up with other groups. The B-24s and B-17s flew directly over the beachhead to let the American infantry see their awesome power. Lanford remembered it as an exciting, unforgettable sight. The bombers stretched as far as you could see in front and as far as you could see in back. To provide adequate space and runways for the B-24s and B-17s, the Americans brought in bulldozers. They leveled what had once been wheat fields. Engineers laid down steel matting for the 4,800-foot runway and made taxiways and hard stands. They did not bother to make hangars. All maintenance, repairs, and other work on the bombers was done in the open from the first and until the end of the war. The 456th Bomb Group had confiscated an old farm building to use as headquarters. There were 2 brick buildings used as aircrew briefing rooms and navigators and bombardiers' study rooms. The 455th Bomb Group had its headquarters on the other side of the runway. It had been part of a nobleman's estate, but was sadly neglected. Group headquarters was located in a farm animal stable, which was also used for briefing the crews for the combat missions. The building, made of stone with no windows, had sunk into the ground. The men had to clean out manure that had been accumulating for years and fight off the fleas as they were working. The briefing room was later also used as a movie theater. Lanford, commanding the 741st, won the right to a barn in a coin flip with the commander of the 743rd. It had 2 big bays and an aviary on top. Next to it was a small storage building which went to the 743rd. For the 741st, Lanford made an officer's club in one of the bays and an airman's club out of the other, after clearing out tons of junk. In the aviary, Lanford knocked off the bird perches and sealed the holes and cleaned up the interior, painted it, and built a ladder to climb up to it. The aviary thus became the quarters for Lanford and five other officers. At first, the enlisted men of the 741st slept in the big plywood boxes that lined the bomb bays in which baggage was placed in the B-24s for the flight over to Italy. "You can't imagine those living conditions," Lanford said. The only tent was used as a mess tent. The men had to stand in line to have their mess kit filled, and when it rained, as it often did, they had to run for cover. Lanford hired local labor to put up a mess hall made of stone. In the process, he learned that one of the residents was reporting on what went on at the airfield to the Germans. One night, during construction, the German propaganda broadcaster, nicknamed Axis Sally by the Americans, who liked to listen to her program because she played American music, said, "We see you down there, 741st Squadron, building your mess hall. You'll never get to use it. We'll bomb it before it's complete." The Germans never did bomb it. The base was defended by a British anti-aircraft gun crew, as Cerignola was in the British 8th Army area. Axis Sally seemed to know everything. Radio operator Sergeant Robert Hammer was in the 742nd Squadron. Once, in the spring of 1944, his squadron, nicknamed the Checkerboards because of their tail insignia, was on a mission when two ME-109s went after a straggler that had lost an engine. The pilot of the bomber ordered the crew to lower the landing gear as a sign of surrender. The ME-109s came in close to escort the B-24 to a landing field, one off each wing. The pilot told the crew to open fire. They knocked both fighters down, and the pilot returned to base safely. That night, Axis Sally declared that the Checkerboard B-24s would thereafter be the top priority of the German fighters. The squadron changed its insignia several times, but the Germans kept after it. Hammer said that the Germans had fantastic intelligence reports. Berlin radio would tell us where we were going even before we got off the ground. In early 1944, Lieutenant Robert Capps arrived to join the 744th Squadron. We were deposited on bare, damp ground in olive groves. We were instructed to pitch tents on the hard, moist ground like Boy Scouts. The olive groves became muddy quagmires from rain mixed with human activity. The men anchored the pyramidal tents by ropes attached to the olive trees. There was one tent for the three or four officers and another for the six enlisted men, side by side. They slept on fold-up cots, with either two wool blankets or a sleeping bag for cover. The men made mattresses by packing straw into cloth mattress covers, but the straw had insects in it, which led to bites. If a man touched the inside of the tent while it was raining, the tent leaked. It was cold. It snowed more than once in the winter of 1944 to 1945, so the inhabitants applied a bit of Yankee ingenuity by rigging a stove from a 55-gallon oil drum cut in half. The fuel was gasoline, fed into the stove through a makeshift plumbing device from another full drum outside. It was a drip-by-drip method. The men cut a little door at the bottom of the stove for ventilation. If the stove got too hot, it burned too high, and soot would build up in the smokestack and ignite, sending hot sparks out the chimney, then down onto the tent. The holes caused other leaks. The floor was mud. To make it livable, the men would build a concrete floor, assisted by hired Italian labor. First, they put down crushed rock, then topped it with a layer of concrete. Bill Rounds, who shared a tent with McGovern and Sam Adams, wrote in his diary, "We sleep in tents, no lights or running water." Soon there were lights, a single bulb hanging in the center, and by December 4, 1944, Rounds could write in his diary, "Our tent is now in good shape, good stove, clothes rack, and front door." McGovern, Rounds, and Adams's tent was located near two of the more elaborate tents that were occupied by veterans who were close to the end of the 35 missions required to go home. McGovern met one of the pilots for the first time when he and Rounds went for a joyride in a liberated Jeep. Rounds was driving at high speed. he flew down between the tents, turned a corner on two wheels, caught one of the ropes from the veteran's tent, and the ensuing rip tore the tent in half. The stove, uniforms on hangers, shelves of books, magazines, and photographs all flew into the olive grove. Climbing out of the jeep, McGovern saw an aging pilot with heavy circles under his eyes, who had to be at least 25, walking over to the vehicle. His name, McGovern found out later, was Captain Howard Serbeck. His voice, quaking with rage, Serbeck said, "You two sons of bitches will never make it through combat. I should kill you right now." Rounds and McGovern spent the rest of the day putting up a new tent for him. "So," McGovern recalled with a laugh, "that's the way I broke into the 741st Squadron area." Rounds was nonetheless unstoppable in his practical jokes. One night, shortly after the incident with the jeep, he rolled a 55-gallon drum of fuel oil into the middle of the squadron area, set it on fire, and shouted, "Enemy raid!" There were cries of panic and anguish all around, except from Rounds, who was laughing. Adams was different, a capable, highly conscientious technician. He wanted only to do his part in winning the war, then get back to Milwaukee as quickly as possible to begin his studies to become a minister. He and McGovern talked almost always, it seemed, about everything. Adams spent what idle hours he had writing long letters home, cleaning his equipment, reading, or simply lying on his cot thinking. McGovern also did a lot of reading and writing letters to Eleanor. After he began flying in combat, he always put in a number, which seemed innocent enough to the censors, but each one was the number of missions he had flown. Eleanor knew that 35 was the magic number. When George had completed 35 missions, he could come home. Those who arrived in the summer or fall of 1944 were assigned to tents already in place. This had its good points, but one notable drawback as well. Frequently, the tent had belonged to a crew that had been shot down. When pilot Lieutenant Donald Kay of the 465th Bomb Group arrived in Chirignola, he heard those who were already there call out, "You'll be sorry." He and his crew took over the tents that had been those of a Lieutenant Greenwood and his crew, who had been shot down 2 days before Kay's arrival. The food may have been the envy of the people of Chirignola, but it was never close to the standards the Yanks were accustomed to eating. Powdered eggs were the breakfast staple, served in various forms, often scrambled. But no matter what was done with the eggs, most of them ended up in the garbage can. There were pancakes, made from flour and the powdered eggs. They looked like and had the consistency of a frisbee. The Army-issued tropical butter was treated to prevent spoilage under any imaginable circumstance, so it was too hard to melt no matter what was tried. The bread was fresh, baked on the site by the cooks, but it was coarse and suitable only for French toast, again made with powdered eggs. Sometimes there was oatmeal, but it was on the rubbery side, and Lieutenant Roland Pepin of the 741st was convinced that what wasn't consumed was used to repair the planes, as it was gooey and sticky enough to be useful. At noon and in the evening, there was canned food, stewed prunes, hash heated in garbage cans, and meat, which was mostly Spam, called mystery meat. Like nearly every serviceman in the armed forces of the United States, the AAF men at Chirignola came to hate the sight of Spam. This was true even at the very top. After the war, General Eisenhower met the president of the Hormel Company and thanked him for the Spam, then added, with a grin, "But did you have to send us so much of it?" One writer in the 455th, calling himself Anonymous, commented, "For breakfast, the cooks will fry it. At dinner, it is baked. For supper, they have it patty-caked. Next morning, it's with flapjacks. Where the hell do they get it all? They must order it by kegs. Spam in stew, Spam in pies, and Spam in boiling grease." At Chirignola, the alternative to Spam was canned Vienna sausages. After a month of eating them, one of the men tacked a proposal on the squadron ready room door, offering to stop bombing Vienna if its people would stop sending their sausages. Lieutenant Shostak had flown 2,500 cases of K-rations in his B-24 to Chirignola and had discovered that nobody wanted it. So he put the cases into his tent, and whenever he could, he would take 10 boxes of them into town, go to what passed for a restaurant, and trade them for an Italian spaghetti dinner. The spaghetti sauce had no meat in it, but the Italians had great tomato sauce and a bottle of cheap wine to go with the meal. Whenever weather prevented a mission, which happened often, some of the men would try to break the monotony at the base by going into town. The AAF sent in a truck every half hour or so, which would then wait at an intersection so guys going back had a ride. There was a Red Cross club across the street from the cathedral, with a movie theater for the Americans, a pool table, books, and cards. The men had ample money. They were paid in Allied military currency, which at 1 penny to the lira was the legal tender for occupied Italy. The exchange rate was more than favorable. Skilled Italian laborers, those who helped put in the concrete floors or worked on the runway or elsewhere, were paid 75 lira a day. Unskilled laborers received 50 lira a day. A haircut in town was 7 lira. A shave cost the same. To the initial surprise of the Yanks, there were barbers all along the streets, usually small boys with straight razors. Lieutenant Donald Currier noted that, "As poor as the people were, many of the Italian old men went to the barber for their shave every day. It was a male ritual." For a hot bath, unavailable at the base, the men went to a public bath at Cirignola. They brought their own soap and towel. The cost was 25 lira. Another surprise to the Yanks, the residents of Cirignola wore, mostly, only black clothes. The poverty of the people precluded bright, colorful clothes. Many of them were starving, or nearly so. "We watched the women standing in long lines with their pieces of cloth," Currier wrote, "waiting for their small allotment of flour." The flour came from the American supplies. Hard to imagine, flour coming from the States to the Romans' land of cereal, where Hannibal had had his supply base. Currier also noted that on the roofs of ancient houses there were bundles of twigs and small branches. This was the fuel they cooked with. The AAF men would bring their laundry into town, where, for a few lira, the local women would wash it and hang it out to dry, then fold it. Lieutenant Pepin went into Cirignola frequently. There he had met a teenage girl named Maria, cute and dark-eyed. He overcame his inability to speak Italian by using his high school French. Maria had also learned some French in school. He recalled that the customary way of the Italians required the meeting of the family as a prerequisite to any form of social contact. Maria lived with her grandmother, mother, and 2 aunts. All the men of the family had died in the war. "The women accepted me, but I doubt if they ever trusted me. Maria and I were never alone for more than a few moments. A fleeting kiss now and then was permissible, but nothing else." For Pepin, the friendship of the family and his visiting in their home became very important to me. It offset the inhumane rigors of war and added gentleness to my life. He wrote his own mother about Maria. She sent him packages of women's clothing. Maria and her family were overjoyed and honored me with great meals. But, Pepin added regretfully, I won no free time with Maria. Cesaro Ruggiero, a 30-year-old who had been in and gotten out of the Italian army, worked at the airfield. One day he brought an American pilot to his home for a lunch made by his mother. She served pasta, with no meat, no cheese, no tomato sauce. Still, the pasta was homemade, and the wheat was homegrown, and the American ate it with gusto. Ruggiero's mother said, if there were meat, it would be better. It would be ragu. The next day, an American truck pulled up outside her home. The driver unloaded 100 tins of meat, chicken breast, beef, bacon, and the inevitable Spam. Ruggiero said the Americans brought richness to us. Sergeant Joseph Maloney, 20 years old, was a tail gunner on his B-24 in the 415th Squadron, 98th Bomb Group, based near Cirignola. A child of the Depression, Joe knew hard times. He found a 9-year-old Italian boy named Gino, who would come every week to clean his tent, and he paid far above the going rate for it, just to help out the boy's family. Gino's mother did his laundry in return for a cake of soap. Gino also supplied him with fresh eggs on occasion, for which Joe paid him 2 packs of American cigarettes. Sergeant Anthony Picardi of the 742nd Squadron got to visit Volturara Erpina, the village where his mother, father, and oldest sister were born. As we arrived in the village square, people were pointing and asking questions. Sono Americani? Are you American? I answered back yes, in Italian. They ran off to seek my relatives and tell them that I had arrived from America. I never knew I had so many relatives in Italy. I met my uncle, aunt, and cousins. Everyone was happy, hugging and kissing. I met my grandmother, who was 90 years old at the time. That was the first and last time I would ever see her. She embraced me and said, "Figlio mio, my son." It was a very emotional moment. I could not, for the love of me, figure out how she recognized me. She said I had my father's face, and she knew immediately who I was. Picardi handed out gifts, candy, sugar, coffee, cigarettes, and more. He had saved the items from his purchases at the PX for the occasion. Francesco Musto was born in Cirignola in 1928, the oldest of what became a family of 9 children. His father was a skilled electrician, but his house had no running water. His mother bought the water in containers brought to her from the town fountain by small boys. After 1939, there was no salt at all, no sugar for months, and often no milk. As a boy, Musto would ride his bike for 10 kilometers to a farm to get a bit of milk for his 1-year-old sister. In his memory, the townspeople had little or no contact with the German occupiers of Italy, and nothing the Germans did impressed them. The Americans, however, opened our minds in an incredible way. Musto recalls that when the AAF came, "I can remember that for 3 weeks, 3 full weeks, on the road outside our house for 24 hours a day, we had a continuous flow of everything, trucks, jeeps, tanks, amphibious vehicles, everything." Then, in just a few days, the Americans built their airfield. They put up their tents, made the briefing room and headquarters building, and more. They threw away a lot. Musto managed to salvage a radio and other items. "So I discovered an entire world of new products, technologies, services." On the radio, he listened to something I had never heard before, the music of Glenn Miller. Like everyone else, he loved it. There were some romances between American servicemen and the local women, and at least 100 marriages resulted. But there were many women selling themselves. In Musto's memory, there were too many girls doing what they should never have been doing. There was a terrible degradation of morality. There were many Italian Americans in the AAF, most of whom spoke Italian, but not well, at least according to Musto. He said, "They spoke some horrible dialects that we couldn't understand. They were dialects used more than a century previous." As for food, the first thing that the Americans brought was the very white bread. White, incredibly white. White like milk. The second thing that impressed Musto was the variety. The people of Cirignola were accustomed to dried fava beans with chicory and a little bit of olive oil, and sometimes fish from the sea. But the Americans brought in Spam, peanut butter, chocolate, and so much more. As far as Musto was concerned, this was modernity. The new world was this one. The local residents went to work for the Americans, another miracle. First, the Americans would hire women to clean, wash clothes, prepare food, and so on, and pay them for it. Second, the men could get almost any kind of work on the airfields, in the barracks, everywhere. Best of all, it wasn't day work as they were accustomed to, one day on, many days off, but steady. 3 months, 4 months, more. Along with the work for women, this was an incredible novelty. According to Gionanna Pistachio Colucci, a 25-year-old married woman and mother in 1944, everything about the Americans was fantastic, marvelous. When the Americans arrived, it was a joyous celebration. The Red Cross was here, the children got covers for their beds, they had clothes, jackets. The Americans also brought medicines. She recalled that the day before the Germans fled and the Americans moved in, a group of Italian soldiers, deserters, unarmed local boys, appeared in Cirignola. The Germans killed them all and put their bodies into one of the Roman granaries. Today, the Cerignola Cemetery has a monument to these boys. Many local people can never forgive the Germans for the atrocity. But, Colucci said, we have a beautiful memory of the Americans. Michela Bancoli, a 16-year-old boy who worked at the airfield, recalled that he had keys to the American warehouse. Unbelievable. But they trusted us. He added that a typical characteristic of the Americans was that they were handsome. He was especially impressed by their physical appearance and the way they played sports such as softball or engaged in boxing matches. He and other boys would watch. Bancoli was impressed because the Americans knew first to enjoy life and then after that to go to work. Mario Carpasafala was a 10-year-old boy when the Americans came. He went to work for them, doing whatever needed doing, sometimes for money, other times for cigarettes. When the German soldiers had occupied Cerignola, Mario remembered seeing a loaf of black bread on a truck. The German driver had stopped to be shaved. Mario had to have that bread. He grabbed it. Just then, some other German soldiers came down the street and one of them shouted. Mario tried to hide behind a Roman milestone. A soldier aimed his rifle at him. Mario threw the bread down the street and took off running. Decades later, he would show the spot to his children and comment, "Look, there, for a loaf of bread, I almost lost my life." The Americans were different. Once, Mario was scrounging around a garbage pit gathering food. Nearby were some crushed cigarette butts, which Mario was also pocketing. An American sergeant grabbed him. "Kid, what are you doing? You're too young to smoke." With his broken English, Mario said he was taking the cigarettes for his father, the food for his mother. "Throw that shit away," the sergeant said. "Come with me." He took Mario to the supply tent and gave him some rations and packs of cigarettes. One of the bombardiers stationed in Cerignola, Major Riccardi, was the child of immigrant parents from Italy. He had four brothers in the service during the war. He took Mario under his wing. Each day he taught Mario English words, and after missions would review them with him. Mario learned the language, and later said that had it not been for Riccardi's influence and English lessons, I would have been a bum. As for politics, there was little discussion by the people of Cerignola. Many who had been fascists in the 1930s changed their minds. The one topic everyone agreed upon was how crazy Mussolini must have been to get into the war. "Look at Spain," people would say. "It is a fascist country, but General Franco keeps Spain out of the war. Why didn't Mussolini?" According to Musto, Italy made two mistakes. First, entering the war. Second, entering on the wrong side.